This week's icon of Irish science is an engineer, considered to be one of the greatest ever to come out of Ireland and Britain. His name is Sir Charles Parsons. We are joined by Professor Garrett Scaife, author of From Galaxies to Turbines, Science, Technology and the Parsons Family, to find out about this man and how he changed the world we live in. Professor Scaife, why should we remember Charles Parsons?
Well, we should remember Charles Parsons because he made a huge impact on our modern lifestyle. He was responsible for developing the world's first steam turbine, and this transformed society in an unimaginable way at a critical juncture. The emergence of electric power as an important item happened around about the same time as Charles Parsons was working on his steam turbine. Thomas Edison's ingenuity had turned the researchers of Faraday into a product, electric lighting in particular, that people wanted to possess in their own homes. Charles Parsons, in his efforts to realise a practical steam turbine, had a difficulty in dealing with something that rotated at enormous speeds. And he was able to harness that power because he could attach his steam turbine to an electric generator. And that made his turbine much more practical.
And the applications for this turbine were many.
Anything that required power, mechanical power, was a customer for the turbine. Of course, electricity was the chief user of the steam turbine in the longer run. But as well, in the beginning, steam turbines were used not just to generate electricity, but to drive ships, particularly ships like ocean liners and huge battleships.
How much was the steam turbine a quantum leap from what was there before?
Well, it was enormous. But it wasn't enormous initially. It was potential. The steam engine had built-in limitations in it, and the steam turbine had none of these. So one could envisage that you made bigger and bigger steam turbines almost without limit. The steam turbine that he made initially had an output of about 10 horsepower. The steam turbines down in County Clare have outputs of something like 500,000 horsepower. And they're not the biggest in the world, even so.
And is it true that the electrical generation stations around the world today, the turbines in those are based on his original designs?
Yes, that's certainly true. The steam turbines are visibly descendants. They're different, of course, and they're different in scale, but you can identify the same components in the early ones and the present-day ones. The thing that has changed in the very recent past is that modern engineers have succeeded in doing what he was unable to do, and that is to make a gas turbine, a turbine that would respond to hot gas. It's a big challenge, but of course all aircraft have them, and most modern stations that burn natural gas have them.
When did he first show an interest in engines and the designing of engines?
Engines were a fact of life down in Birr. It's extraordinary to say this. His father, when he was only about 24 or 25, built an engine, a steam engine, a small one, in Birr. Small steam engines weren't that common. Steam trains were only appearing on the scene at that time. So this engine was used to drive the machinery for making the telescope. Later on, there were other steam engines in Birr. For example, the boys converted one of these, mounted it on a platform, put wheels on it, and used it as a kind of road vehicle. It had tragic consequences because while they were out on one occasion with their tutor and one of the cousins of the family, a noted scientist in her own right, Mary Ward, the vehicle hit a curb and she was thrown from the vehicle and killed. And so she was probably the first victim of a road accident in Ireland from a motor-propelled vehicle.
He wasn't an easy man to work with, was he?
No, that's absolutely true. He had a short fuse, and there's plenty of evidence of this, and it was a lifelong failing. His wife commented that when she first met him, her recollection was that he was a weird young man, but understood to be very clever. And there was an occasion that she recalled when they were abroad at some visit or another, and he lost his rag, and he blew up, as she said. And her comment was, "I just walked away and didn't own him."
But I suppose his determination was what drove his success as an inventor.
Yes, several people commented that once he was tackling a problem, once there was some aspect of design that was bothering him, he would just get stuck into it and he would work continuously, non-stop, day and night for several days on the job until he'd arrived at a solution.
Where would you put Parsons amongst the greats of engineering?
Well, in his lifetime, think in Britain, living on the glories of its industry and the Industrial Revolution, that one of the revered figures was James Watt, the Scotsman who had turned the steam engine into a completely new kind of device. Charles Parsons was recognised as standing beside Watt. When there are people who had recollected that when he went to conferences in Europe between the wars, people would turn to one another at a conference and they would say, "What does Parsons say about this?" Because, you know, it was understood his was the last word on the subject.
Tell us about Parsons, the businessman.
There are two things to be said about him. One was that he minded his pennies very well. He didn't waste money. Maybe he was too parsimonious with money, but that was a virtue. The other asset which he took great care to protect was his intellectual property. He had a great collection of patents covering his different inventions, and he had a very sophisticated and active group protecting his inventions, and he protected them, but at the same time he licensed people very freely. And so the result was his income, his net income from his inventions by his intellectual property, was probably equal to the profits he got from his manufacturing.
Professor Gareth Gave, thank you. We are now going to go to Birr Castle to talk to the great-grandnephew of Sir Charles Parsons, the current Earl of Ross. Lord Ross, Charles Parsons' father was a prestigious scientist and astronomer. Isn't that true?
I think Charles Parsons' father, the third Earl, was many things. He had, though, first and foremost, to be an engineer in order to work out how to make, with the resources at his disposal, everything that enabled him to not only build the great telescope that was the biggest in the world before the 20th century, but to make it work. How to make the mirror for the telescope to see, how to make the telescope move from side to side, how to grind and then polish the mirrors to enable the telescope to see, and all of that. He had to be a great engineer and a self-taught engineer, because he was never at school anywhere before he went to University of Trinity. Nearly all of that was self-taught, but it was self-taught engineering that made everything else that followed possible. I think one of the most amazing things is the way he obviously mobilised the human resources of Birr, the builders and the boatsmen, the coopers and the carpenters, and the blacksmiths most of all, were the resources that he mobilised and used to make the great telescope.
And Charles Parsons was educated at home by Robert Ball, the mathematician, isn't that correct?
He was educated at home by a series of tutors who were engaged principally as assistant astronomers at the telescope. And it was they who had to double as tutors for the boys. His father was a very nationalistic and patriotic sort of Irishman who, for various reasons, objected to the principle of any of his boys going off to school in England.
Right, which is unusual at that time.
Which was very unusual, but I think everything about the family was very unusual.
Yeah.
They were out of context. many of the other families spent so much of their time hunting and shooting and fishing.
And why was that? Why were they so different to you know, their contemporaries of the time?
I'm not sure why, but there was, even when the third Earl was born, quite a tradition of that. They were unusual, I think, for being as patriotic and loving and worshipping and really working for Ireland as strongly as they did, and being as strongly opposed to the Union as they were. And that, I think, the disenchantment that was provoked, the frustration, the annoyance, the fury that was generated by the pushing through of the Union with the aid of these colossal bribes, probably turned the family in the preceding generation away from any form of politics, as away from sports, to field scientific. The first great achievement of Burr was the building of a suspension bridge sometime between 1815 and 1820. And I think it was possibly that, this extraordinary, brand-new, revolutionary concept of a wire suspension bridge suspended over these rapids, that instilled in the boys a desire to go out and build other things, create more.
Can you tell us about his father and what sort of an inspiration he was on his son Charles?
Remember that it was his father, the third Earl, who needed a number of people to help him to operate the telescope and to observe every night, and that caused him to engage these assistants at the telescope, and then to hit on the idea that I think can't have been accidental of using these people to tutor the boys.
And he would have been...
those poor tutors had to work jolly hard. They had to work at the telescope all night and tutored the boys all day. And they did occasionally, I think, comment on the fact that they didn't get too much sleep. And Sir Robert Ball wasn't by any means the only one. There was a whole succession of these assistant astronomers who acted as, who doubled as tutors for the boys. And I think it was that that moulded the boys into the people that they became. And Charles Parson wasn't the only. I mean, his elder brother, who became the fourth Earl, was also another astronomer of event, the first person who ever accurately measured the heat of the moon, for instance.
Sure.
And another brother went off to build railways and devise the master plan for water and sewage in the city of Buenos Aires. So they were all quite creative in their ways.
So after his schooling here in Burr, he went then where for his further education?
He went also to Trinity and then on, in his case, to Cambridge out in Oxford.
Lord Ross, Charles Parsons was in Cambridge studying engineering, and following that he went on and he took an apprenticeship. And can you tell me about that apprenticeship?
He did go into apprenticeship, which was not only unusual, I think it was unique for someone of his background, but it was certainly something that suited him very well because it enabled him to work on the shop floor, as we now call it, directly with the people concerned. Though he had a big problem of communicating with them because his brogue was so thick that he couldn't easily be understood, even then, and particularly later on in Newcastle, where he had great difficulty understanding the Geordie accent.
His education had very much a European focus to it, did it?
I think it had a broad European orientation as much as it was very unusual here. And this probably reflected the education of the third Earl, who was also brought up by tutors, of whom the first was French, or French-speaking. And the same condition, I think, followed on for the next two generations. There was a tradition, for instance, that they be brought up with at least two or three languages, French and German rather than Irish, I'd have to admit. And his father, the third Earl's first letters to survive, are in fact in French rather than English, addressed to son très précieux papa, which I think is very interesting.
Did he have a particular interest in the sea?
I think he did. He must have had a particular interest in the sea from earliest childhood. His parents, the third Earl and Mary Ross, had this lovely vessel, the Titania, that they went sailing round Europe on, and bits of whose mast you see here, bits of whose deck you see there, and all the other impedimenta for fishing tackle and everything else. He would have been sailing on this ship here, this sailing ship, motorised sailing ship, round Europe as far as Gibraltar, right up the Scheldt in Belgium, where his mother got these pieces, from an early age. And I think that must have given him his first sea legs and his first real interest in boats, maybe making boats go even faster than that vessel, the Titania, could. and giving that ambition to power them faster than they'd and make them go faster than any boat had ever been able to go before. His ultimate success was, of course, the development of this steam turbine that led eventually to powering the fastest ships afloat in the whole world at the turn of the 19th, 20th century.
And this he did in front of Queen Victoria?
He did in front of the greatest armada, the greatest naval review that the world has ever seen to this day. Even the great one now marking the bicentenary of the Battle of Trafalgar is nothing like as big as this review that I think had the 14 different fleets from all the naval powers of the world assembled there, with all these huge ships, as you see here, battle cruisers, destroyers and everything else, and this tiny little boat that he first thought up here and made there in Newcastle, that was only 7 foot wide, charged onto this parade. It did figures of eight round these huge battleships with all the admirals on board. And
thus proving that his engine was the most effective and efficient engine that was available at that time.
Indeed, I think it was a fantastic act of salesmanship, showmanship and everything else, and made its point, because before the end of the day he was being queried. He'd attracted the attention of not only the Royal Navy, that was deeply embarrassed by the whole of the incident, but the German Navy and every other Navy, and that resulted to his getting awards from the Germans and everyone else. He's the first non-German ever to be given the famous the white gold of the German Engineering Institute. That was for the steam turbine. He was also the first engineer ever to be then given the very coveted Order of Merit, specifically for engineering, and that you see in his formal portrait there even takes precedence over his knighthood as a knight of the Order of the Bath.
In the family, how was he? What was he thought of? Or, you know, was he an eccentric individual?
I think most of our family have always been regarded as eccentrics by outsiders. I think he might have been even regarded as an eccentric by some of the insiders. My grandmother sometimes used to dismiss him as just an engineer, as though that was some sort of derogatory comment. But my father certainly enormously admired him, and I'm only sad that he died before I came into the world. I'd love to have met him and think of him as in these little cartoons here, playing with boats in his bath and wondering what he might have been able to inspire me to do and achieve.
Lord Ross, great-great-grandnephew of Charles Parsons, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. We're immensely proud. I think we're prouder of this particular part of our heritage, the achievements and inventions of Charles Parsons, than any other single component of our fairly broad scientific heritage at Birr.
We've travelled down from salubrious surroundings of Birr Castle down to the aerodynamic lab at the University of Limerick. I'm joined by Dr. Ed Walsh and Professor Mark Davis of the lab. Mark, we're standing here in front of a jet engine. Tell us something about it.
Well, always the difficult thing to get about a jet engine is it seems to be configured the wrong way around. That is that the front of the engine has got the compressor in it, which I'll come back to in a second. And then you get the combustion chamber in the middle where we burn the fuel. And then we get the turbine at the back. And so what we see with the turbine is something which is very, very similar to the turbines that were first invented by Charles Parsons. So what we see here is lots of different blades. And you can see that the thing rotates. And we can see blade row after blade row after blade row. As the air flows through this, it's systematically, stage after stage after stage, compressed. And you can see that the flow of air has a smaller and smaller area as you go through, and the blades get smaller and smaller because the air is taking up less and less space as it's being compressed. So once we've done that to it, really the job is done, and then we could blow it out the back. But somehow we have to put energy into this system to get all this to work. Somehow we have to drive this compressor, these rotating blades, to get the whole thing to work. And this is where the turbine comes in. So the turbine is connected to the compressor. So it's the turbine which extracts energy from the air and turns that energy into a rotation of a shaft. This is what Parsons first did. This was Parsons' great impact upon the world of science and technology, that he designed for the first time a multi-stage turbine which extracted energy from a flow of a gas to rotate a shaft. So this was a big problem in the industrial times, was how do we create shaft work? How do we create a rotating shaft?
Now, he obviously didn't do this for jet airlines. This is a man from the 19th century, and he did it for marine engines and for the generation of electricity. Is that right?
That's right. These were the problems that confronted them at the time. Electrical magnetism was beginning to be understood quite well, and it was understood that if you could generate electricity, then we would have a very, very versatile form of energy. So if we could take a fuel, coal, whatever, and turn that fuel, the energy released when you combust that into electricity, you had a much, much more versatile form of energy. So the idea was then, could we generate electricity? Now, he understood extremely well that you couldn't generate electricity very efficiently using the big reciprocating steam engines at the time. He knew that you had to produce a high-speed engine, and this was the engine that he produced, the original Parsons steam turbine. And before we go back to the jet engine, it's worth noting that almost all the electricity which is consumed in Ireland and anywhere in the world is produced by Parsons steam turbine engines. They're not called that anymore because lots of different companies make them, but the steam turbines that generate electricity here, we've one down on the Shannon, the Money Point Power Station, what you have there is a turbine that would be easily recognisable by Parsons as a derivative of the thing that he first invented well over 100 years ago.
His technology?
His technology, absolutely, entirely his technology, and the impact that he had was enormous. He went on from then to install these things into boats, but his impact was there firstly in terms of steam turbine, but then the technology that he developed, it was realised much later on, could also be used with the flow of a gas instead of the flow of a steam, and that's what you see here in the jet engine in front of you. So, in fact, you can see this line through from Parsons' original work for generating electricity through to the propulsion of aircraft. So when you're flying away on your holidays, and the thing that's holding you up there is based upon the design of this brilliant Irish engineer.
And, of course, the engines that predated Parsons were very inefficient. They used a lot of fossil fuels. They were burning up our natural resources much, much quicker. This was an influence behind Parsons' work.
That's why we still burn fossil fuels to create electrical energy, because people like Parsons developed a technology which was actually so efficient, so incredibly efficient, yeah, in comparison to anything that went before it.
And can you put that into some sort of context in terms of the engines pre-Parsons and the engines he developed?
The first steam engines, big reciprocating steam engines that went into trains and pumped from mines and things like that, were so inefficient that it was thought that all of the energy that came out of burning coal, the fuel that was fueling these things, was turned into heat and lost. That is, that the amount that was turned into work was, in comparison, unmeasurable. So the things were a fraction of a percent efficient. The kind of steam turbines that we're looking at today, it doesn't sound terribly good, but they're about 40% efficient, 40, 50% efficient. That is, about half of the energy which is extracted from the fuel is turned into useful electricity, which you and I use every day. So first of all, he generated electricity, and he did so much of the technological development. He not only designed the turbines, he designed the electrical generators. He had to do novel work on seals. In fact, if you look at the way that the seals operate within this to stop the gases from leaking in this engine, you'll find that there are labyrinth seals which were first designed and patented by Parsons. Enormous impact. On small-scale things like that, of which if he hadn't have designed them, the whole thing would never have worked.
Would you say the Parsons changed the world?
It's always difficult to say. It's difficult to know whether somebody else how long it would have taken for somebody else to come up with the same invention. That's always difficult. We're stood in front of a jet engine, and this was developed exactly the same time in Germany and Britain. So good inventions do tend to have their time. I don't know how long it would have taken for somebody else to have come up with the idea. But certainly he personally has had an enormous impact, and it's great that an Irish engineer's name is associated with this fantastically good technology.
Ed, tell us about the work that you do here at the University of Limerick.
Well, the work is quite varied. My PhD was on a transonic flows, which is high-speed gas flows, which again Parsons realised immediately and was one of the key problems, was that to be efficient with engines, you need to run them at very high velocities. And that's where a lot of his contemporaries fell down. Rotation speeds required high, strong bearing solutions and so on. My own work here is really trying to make them that little bit more efficient, whereas Parsons went from practically 0% to maybe 5 or 6% of his first engine. I'm going from maybe 39% to 39.5%. So the gains to be made that sure. These days are not that great, but the potential of those small gains is still massive.
And you're working on jet engines, are you?
Yes, I work on a part of jet. I work on the turbine, part of redesigned blades, looking at the flows through them, looking at entropy generation rates, transitions, these kind of keywords in aerodynamics at the moment.
We have a Charles Parsons Lecture Theatre here, which has got a big display up on the wall, so that the students probably get it quite young.
Yes, interesting. That's probably where I heard the name first was in that theatre.
Presumably anybody in your field, wherever they are in the world, would have come across Parsons and would know of his significance.
Yes. The aviation industry as it exists today is probably a reflection of Parsons' early work, and everybody in that industry and power industry and major boat manufacturing industry.
He was terribly versatile as well. He made small steam engines to drive model aircraft, so there's photographs of him with his son flying model aircraft with tiny engines that he produced, he designed and produced himself. So he was a very, very innovative man, and of course not only designed, you know, the major design breakthroughs like with the turbine, but he did the detailed design of them as well and made lots of minor breakthroughs that were necessary, and was also, of course, so instrumental in getting things manufactured, so these things had to be made, and he did all of it.
I think from that point of view, I mean, I think that's really what made him stand out. He'd done all the small things as well as the big ideas. It wasn't just small. It wasn't just he came up with putting many stages together, multi-stage turbines. He came up with all the other small things that were required to make it work. And that's really what made him stand out from these other 200 or so patents that went in before him.
Professor Mark Davis, Dr. Ed Walsh, thank you.